Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now is retired United States Air Force General Hawk Carlisle, the president and CEO of the National Defense Industrial Association. Hawk, thanks so very much for joining us.
Thanks, Vago. It's great to be here. And as always, it's great to have a conversation with you. Thank you.
An absolute pleasure, sir. We know how busy you are, and thanks for joining us. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And Bell, of course, sponsors this podcast. Sir, it's been a couple of months since last we spoke. It was just before the SOFIC or the virtual SOFIC trade show. And that was certainly a very novel way of presenting what is the Special Operations Community's annual flagship event down in Tampa. We had a great conversation with General Clark and other senior leaders from across SOCOM, and you were kind enough to join us. And at that time, we sort of asked you, like, hey, where are we and where are we going? Here we find ourselves. It's almost August. Where are we and where are we going? What are the challenges? What are the workarounds? And what do you think the environment is going to be like for everybody going forward as we, you know, are in a sweltering summer? The pandemic has been surging, and everybody's got a couple of very, very sharp concerns. AFA has been rescheduled. AUSA has been rescheduled. Where are we and where are we going?
Well, thanks, Vago. It's a great question. So I think, my hat's off to the SOCOM and the NDIA team that put together VSOFIC. About 5,000 folks participated, and it was given the turnaround time we had and when we made the decision and went virtual, it really, really came off well. But, you know, it is. I think the challenge that we're going forward is, you know, we don't know where we're going to land between the two goalposts. I think, you know, when we look at it, it's pretty much all virtual now. And through the end of the calendar year, I believe pretty much everything's going to be virtual because that's the necessity of taking care of the American people and you know, flattening the curve on the pandemic. But on the other side of that is back to in-person events, the networking, the things that you can't do in a virtual environment. You know, I always say virtual presence is actual absence. And I think we're going to go back there, but it won't be the same. I think what we'll see in the future is where we'll land. I think the first 6 months of this year will be everything will be virtual, or the last 6 months rather, as we get through the end of calendar year 20. And as we start 21, you know, therapeutics, vaccines, where we stand as a nation, where the world stands, will be determinants. But at some point after the first of the year, I think we'll start to go back to in-person events. I think everybody will. I think it'll be different. There'll be precautions that'll be taken. There'll be hybrid events. I think most events in the future will be cases where you'll have some in person and some in the virtual space, and we'll kind of find out where that fits in between. But, you know, exhibit floors and networking and one-on-one contact, that's going to still be part of what we do in the future. It's probably down the road a ways, but I think we'll get back to that. It will be different. We've learned from this. We will, I think, more and more do hybrid events, but the rest of 20 is going to be a challenge. And as we start 21, we'll see how we're doing as a nation in dealing with the pandemic.
Indeed, and I think that was your team. I think did a terrific job in trying to structure something that had as many interesting features. And as you said, even before the event, right, the way you guys are mapping this is to take those lessons learned and to fold them in. And I remember when you were Pacific Air Force's commander, you would say, you know, virtual presence is real absence. So certainly appreciate that. And everybody who's in the relationship business is I think, struggling with this ultimately as well, even if we're finding workarounds. This is imposing real cost on people, right? On the one hand, companies are saving on travel budgets that they would otherwise be investing in, and obviously trade show budgets, which has an impact on everybody at the end of the day. But at the same time, are real costs associated to keep production lines and the like going. Congress now is considering its fourth stimulus package. The NDAA has been approved by the House and Senate. It's going to get reconciled. The president has suggested he might veto it, but the measures may have enough of a veto-proof majority at this point, given the president's concerns about Confederate base names being taken off of military installations. And there are some who look at the $740 billion defense budget and they say, look, you know, now that we're not as intensively in Iraq and Afghanistan, the department should cover some of these coronavirus-related charges out of its own budget. And there are all sorts of numbers out there. From your standpoint, representing as the nation's leading defense industrial organization, you've banded together with the Aerospace Industries Association and other groups to sort of advocate for why Congress should cover this. What's the rationale in the case you're making? And how much money, in your estimation, is going to be necessary to fully cover these coronavirus charges?
So I'll kind of cover a little in kind of steps. You know, we're still in coronavirus. We're still having companies that have to close production lines, close factories. It's gone down significantly, but it still exists out there. They've had to go into shift work with social distancing and cleaning requirements and PPE. There's added expense to the industrial partners. How many people they can have, what their productivity is, given the social distancing and again the PPE and those things. It has changed the complexion of the defense industrial base ability to produce and deliver from product type stuff to even services. You know, it's a challenge for the services industry as well. And so, you know, the 3610 adjustments for equitable adjustments and paid leave for people that couldn't come to work because they were quarantining themselves because of contact tracing, or they in fact had it, or they had relatives, or they had at-risk people, or those at-risk people that are part of the workforce, or they were had contact with at-risk people. So, at the end of the day, I think the reason we advocated for this, the next stimulus package and money for DOD is, you know, we determined it was passed by Congress in the 20 budget that this is what we needed to produce for the warfighter in this great power competition. And as of right now, we can't do that. We have to find, you know, we're not going to get the same buying power when we have these added expenses to get the same capability products and services for those warfighters out there. So, I mean, it's logical and it makes sense. Obviously, I think dealing with the pandemic is a national security priority. I think our economy is a national security priority, but the defense budget and where we go and what we're able to do to continue to meet the threats that face this nation and prepare in this great power competition, I think, you know, REA's ability, reasonable equitable adjustments and paid leave and the added cost that industry is going through to still give that capability to the warfighter and Department of Defense, it needs to be covered. And that's why we advocated for it going forward. You know, I think when you talk for just 1 second on the next year's budget, 21, you know, people talk about the size of budget. And again, I think our economy is a national security challenge that we have to be cognizant of. But having said that, you know, if you look at the budget, the actual, you know, it's a very, very small increase. I think it's, you know, 0.5% to 1% is $3.7 billion, I think. And if you look at that with the inflation costs and inside of that, there's a personnel 3% pay raise, DHP, Defense Health Program goes up. So in fact, the next year's budget is reduced buying power for the Department of Defense. They actually can do less. So they're already less than what they were in 20 with the 21 budget and agreed budget position. So, you know, I understand where everybody's coming from on, we have to deal with the pandemic, that's a national security issue. We have to deal with the U.S. economy, that's a national security issue. But we also have great power competition that we have to deal with, and we have to continue to support those warfighters out there that are going to do what the nation asks them to do.
Where are you on the NDAA? Obviously, the House and Senate have finished their authorization measures. Obviously, there's an appropriations process ongoing also. What do you like that's in the measure? What do you not like? Where would you like to end up from an NDIA perspective that represents everything from the biggest companies to the smallest?
Well, I think the top line is reasonable in both bills, both the House and Senate version. And I think if you look at what the Congress has done with respect to great power competition and rising to that, and some of the expenditures on capability, both in the new technologies in the Space Force and where the financing for that has gone, I think some of the moves inside the department to kind of shift the transition to that different national defense strategy, what the Marines are doing, what the Navy's doing, the Air Force, the Army, is all part of that. And so I'm encouraged. I do believe that as we look at buying power and the capability and what's going to happen, you know, the November, we're not sure yet, but what happens in November and post-November and then what the next year's budgets look like is we have got to find ways to be more effective and efficient. And I believe that, you know, one of the challenges that sometimes we face with Congress is getting rid of legacy programs that have less applicability in the new national defense strategy, retiring old aircraft, retiring old systems, program of records that haven't been performing and are not key and critical to the competition that we may face against a Russia, China, Iran. So I think that's one of the things that in both bills we need to work with Congress on is, you know, allow the department to shift resources from some of those legacy programs, legacy systems that were more designed for the past 20 years of national security that we did in the opposing violent extremism in Iraq and Syria, to what's coming next, and that is to shift those resources to newer technology capability that is critical to success in any one of those kind of confrontations and what it takes to be able to do that. So that's the part of the bill that I would like to see DOD and Congress work together on. What are those programs can they draw away from? I do think Congress has been very thoughtful about where they look at how the NDS plays into what's coming next and the new technologies are out there. And I think that is critical as we move forward.
Let me ask kind of a two-part question. There is a move, certainly on the Democratic side, certainly on the progressive side of the party, to do a 10% defense reduction and from a top line perspective, and then redirect some of that savings toward other priorities, whether they're healthcare, whether they're infrastructure or social justice and what have you. At the same time, former Vice President Biden has put out his platform that advocates for a leaner future, more trade-offs, just like you were talking about here. Two-part question. Part one of the question is, How are you interacting with the campaigns at this point in order to try to help shape their thinking and maybe to consider more fully some of the industrial elements of this? Because I know that in each campaign cycle, the leading trade associations always take sort of a flagship role in engaging on behalf of industry with each of the campaigns. Where are you guys in that process now?
So I think at the outset, I would tell you that we are nonpartisan. We believe national security is a national issue, no matter what side of the aisle you sit on. So we are nonpartisan, and we are non-lobbyists. We're a 501c3, you know, honest broker and networking, even playing ground across the field. And so what I would tell you is, with respect to the campaigns, we answer questions and give our professional advice. When asked, we listen to what is coming out of both campaigns and what the policies and platforms are. And we evaluate those based on what we see as national security challenges. And we provide feedback on those based on where we're going. So, you know, we're not actively engaged with any campaign. We're not part of any campaign. Again, we're right. Nonpartisan. But we do look at it as a nonpartisan issue, and a national security is the greater effect of what this nation needs. And it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you sit on. National security is important to everyone. So we are answering questions and evaluating what's coming out. You know, I think, for example, the Biden platform that just came out, you know, there's in both campaigns, there's some really, really smart people looking at this. And I will tell you, again, I understand the need for the U.S. economy is national security, and the fact that this pandemic has raised a lot of thoughts and questions about how do we really defend this nation in different ways against different threats. And obviously a pandemic is a huge threat, as has been proved out in the last 5 or 6 months. So the question to be, I would ask any campaign on both sides of the aisle, is what are you going to stop doing? You know, if there's a more effective and efficient way to do national defense and national security, then let's roll it out and see where the resources come from to go to something different. And I think that's, as I said earlier, I think when you look at this 21 NDAA in the House and Senate version, there is thoughts on where we're going to go, and there's move into some of the new technologies and capabilities based on the current national defense strategy. But I don't see a lot of places where they're willing to stop doing something.
Right.
They're willing to stop programs that are less impactful for the next generation and the next potential threats out there. So, you know, in both campaigns, a 10% reduction, you would have to, I believe, for the Department of Defense, it would be a drastic move of resources from some things to other things to get
right
to where you want to. The worst possible case would be break everything. You know, the peanut butter spread and says, hey, we're going to take a 10% cut, so we're going to cut everything back by 10%. And I will tell you, I know from experience that does not work. You break everything.
Right.
You know, you cut people back, then you don't have enough people to do the missions. If you cut the technology and the new systems back, then you don't have enough to meet the demands of the national security strategy around the world. So, you know, what I would advocate for is, if you're going to do that, no kidding, pick things that you're going to stop doing, programs that are going to end, legacies that you're not going to support anymore. And the things that you're going to do, do them 100% correct, 100% right, so that you make sure that the warfighters have what they need. The worst possible case would be, in my opinion, a peanut butter spread across the entire budget and basically break everything.
What role do you think an organization like NDIA can play in helping make these better choices? Because at the end of the day, the reason we continue doing what we do, even if we don't need some of these systems, is because somebody manufactures them in a district, and especially if it's in a prominent member's district, it's very, very hard to get rid of, right? I mean, the A-10 decision was driven in part because Kelly Ayotte's husband flew A-10s, right? And she was very passionate about the issue. Air Force was like, look, it's time to retire them. And those airplanes stayed in service. So the Air Force has tried that before. I'm not asking you to speak with an Air Force hat, but is there a role that NDIA can play to sort of help shape more thoughtful transition strategies? Because no company wants to regard itself as a buggy whip maker. But in the kind of challenge we're going to in a hypersonic battlefield with contested communications and the kind of high-end threat a China poses or even a Russia poses, you're going to have to make choices about what will work in that environment and what will not. And so there might be a lot of people who may have a lot of good technology but are suddenly buggy whip makers. Do you think there's a role that an NDIA can play in helping shape some transitional strategies to get people to let go? Because when you talk to members of Congress, especially a younger generation, I think there is a genuine understanding that these choices will have to be made and have to be made soon. So the lawmakers seem like they're getting ready for that. Chairman Smith has talked about the importance of making, unfortunately, ripping some of these Band-Aids off. Do you think there's a role that NDIA can play to sort of help shape some thoughtful transitional strategies?
So, yeah, I think NDI can play a key role in that. And part of one of the great advantages we have is we are nonpartisan. We're 501c3 nonprofit, and we have the ability in a networking and listening sessions environment to bring industry leadership and engineers together with the department, with Congress, with the executive branch, with academia, national labs, to talk about these challenges and how we can transition. So part of it, you know, I think a big part of it, and certainly with Congress, is an education, is how do we educate them in what does work and doesn't work in battlefields of the future, and what does that look like in the department, and the strategist and the force design experts are looking at all those things. You know, just seeing the war games and some of the things that we've done in support of the services, and find out what doesn't work, and what some of the things that we need to be able to do in the future to stay ahead of our potential adversaries in this next great power competition, the national defense strategy. So we can provide that venue, that avenue to do that education, and to get the opportunity for industry to hear what the force design and what the strategists are looking at, and Congress to understand why a system isn't applicable going forward. And maybe that's a program we can start to wind down, or we can start to retire some of that capabilities. We bring new technologies on. We're also standing up the Emerging Technologies Institute and NDIA, which is going to look at those new technologies and bringing working groups together to talk about how do you field that capability rapidly and get it out to the warfighter, and what will it replace, and what can you do with that technology that will allow you to change resources from something that's less necessary to something that's more necessary. So that's another avenue. And then, you know, I think ultimately, you know, if one thing that we have learned during this pandemic is we do need to onshore capability inside the United States, as well as with our friends, partners, and allies that'll be around no matter what. And so I think there may be opportunities, these new technologies that come along, our ability to bring some of our manufacturing production capability back to the United States or to our friends, partners, and allies is going to be another opportunity. Because ultimately, I think when you think about Congress, as much as anything, you know, there's that factory that's making the new wings for the A-10. If it could be doing something different, you're still going to employ people there, then that's a win for Congress. So what can we bring into districts and states as we move into this new national defense strategy and new technology emerges? What can we bring into states to continue to grow the economy and the workforce capability within those districts and states? So I think NDIA has a big role to play in that.
Let me ask you about Ellen Lord, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment. You have regular contact with her. In fact, a couple of hours ago, you were part of a conference call with her. She just wrote a very interesting piece in NDIA's own National Defense magazine, talking about her trusted marketplace concept to try to reduce the reach of Chinese capital in investing in high-tech American companies, and thereby being able to gain intellectual property. Talk to us about what's on Undersecretary Lord's mind. What are some of her priorities, and what you're engaging with her to try to address? Because I know that you guys have a long list of rolling issues that she's trying to cover as the Defense Production Act chief of the nation, right? That sort of intermediary on something that's that hasn't been as mobilized as it as perhaps some critics say it should be, but that she's still in the catbird seat on that.
Yeah. So, first of all, I got to tell you, I have all the respect and admiration in the world for Secretary Lord. She's doing great work. Her outreach to industry, and as we stepped into this, she's been doing it the whole time she's been in a position, but certainly during this pandemic, it rose to the top, and she reached out into states and other nations, and she wrote a letter of essentiality, and she's been key in working with across the board with the defense industrial base to continue to supply and support the Department of Defense and our national security. So my hat's off to her. She's done great work. There's so many issues, whether it's the 889 Bravo and that challenge with the with the implementation of that in August, which has to do with restricted companies like Huawei and ZTE, and how you certify that they're nowhere in your supply chain. That's going to be a challenge. And CMMC, the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, and what that looks like going into the future. Clearly, what we've gone through in this pandemic and the work to keep the defense industrial base running, she's been fantastic. On the trusted capital thing, you know, I know some people don't see it quite as clearly, but I think you need to go back and understand and listen and read what the Chinese say. What the Chinese Communist Party says is, we're going to replace the United States economically, we're going to replace the military, and we're going to own the world organizations and the world standards so that we can carve them to fit our needs. And that's a fact. That's what they're trying to do. If you look at the MIL-CIV fusion, military-civil fusion, if you look at Made in China 2025, if you look at the digital Silk Road, if you look at what they're doing inside the South China Sea, if you look at their predatory lending practices and the way they tie nations up with initially the offer of money and then they hold it over their head and use it to their advantage. I just think people have to be straightforward and understand the Chinese are going to steal everything they can. They're going to try to replace us, and they're going to do it by any means they can, and they don't consider international norms to apply to them. We can see it, you know, across the board. You know, everybody talks about 9/11 2001, which was a travesty, but in December of 2001, China was admitted to the WTO. And since then, they have used lawfare and they've used the WTO to their advantage, and they've continued to make inroads. So when it comes to trusted capital, I don't think there's any doubt in anybody's mind, and there shouldn't be any doubt in anybody's mind. If the Chinese are putting money into something and it proves to be a technology that's valuable and can be used in multi-roles and multi-purposes and both in commercial to grow their economy or in military to grow their military capability, they're going to take it. You know, the Communist Party has the ability to do whatever they want with industry in their country and whatever they want with the capital that their capital markets produce and invest. So the idea that, you know, it's not nefarious, it's not for the intent of moving China to number one across the board in the world, then you're naive, because it is. That's what they want to do, and they're going to do everything in their power to do it. So I think the trusted capital is incredibly important. So those companies that have new technologies that maybe don't get the government contract, don't get the SBIR contract, you know, there's probably somebody that is associated with the Chinese Communist Party outside the door waiting for them to come out, that wants to buy into it, is willing to put money against it, but they're also ultimately going to try to take that intellectual property and use it to their advantage. So I just think we need to be clear-eyed and not naive about what the goals of the Chinese are and how they're executing to get there.
Well, that's one of my contentions, is we have to be as organized about this as they have been. And ultimately, they've sort of aligned all of their arms of national power to help achieve what is an important national goal for them. In terms of some specific takeaways, I mean, are there any specific items that Ms. Lord or priorities that she wants you guys to be focused on?
Well, I think the CMMC is critical to her, and how we go forward to protect the intellectual property of the United States and our industrial base. I think trusted capital is another one. I think the other one is we look at new technologies and things like 5G and what this, you know, she's asked us to work with a different companies on a spectrum. How do we deal with the spectrum challenges, especially as we get into 5G as we're going forward. There's 11 critical technologies inside of DOD that DOD has identified that she really wants to see us move out on, which is part of the, you know, nexus and emphasis on the Emerging Technologies Institute as we move forward. So, you know, there's a lot. She is actively trying to ensure that the United States defense industrial base, to include the traditional and the non-traditional members, continues to be the best in the world. And I give her a huge amount of credit for the work she's done to get us there.
We've got about 2 minutes. Let me ask you really quickly on CMMC. Does that survive Katie Arrington's departure? Are you satisfied that that's the right approach? And by CMMC, for those in the audience who don't know, is the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, which is the system that DoD has implemented to kind of rapidly certify people as cyber compliant. There have been some questions about whether that's the right approach. Do you think that's the right approach, or is this an approach you think that can be refined to get to a better outcome?
Well, I think we'll continue to refine it. And I think Katie would tell you the same thing. I mean, it's not set in stone or a done deal now. Even the CMMC accreditation body is still working their way through it. The tools that you do, I think ultimately the goal of CMMC is protecting American intellectual property across the board. I think commercial enterprise is going to have to do the same thing, because again, going back to Chinese trying to grow their economy to be the biggest in the world, we're close to tied now, if not actually tied right now. And so they're stealing intellectual property, not just in high technology and military terms, but from Coca-Cola to other things, they're continuing to do that. So I think the concept of cybersecurity maturity model certification and where we're going, it's the right avenue. Do we know exactly how we're going to get to that end game and how we're going to do this? No, we got a lot to learn and a lot to do. And frankly, technology continues to evolve, which is good and bad. It helps us, but it also helps our potential adversaries out there. So it will continue to refine. The concept of CMMC, I think, will survive. I think everybody realizes the importance and criticality of doing it.
And one last question. DoD has changed progress payment standards. It's accelerated contracts. The whole idea has been able to push as much money to industry to allow it to trickle down. We've got some contractors. Lockheed Martin obviously has spoken very prominently about the thousands of contractors that it's accelerated support to, because obviously our industry depends not just on the giant companies, but also very, very capable, but actually a handful of much, much smaller companies on which everybody depends for some key components, especially. But there are some concerns that those in the mid and the lower tiers especially are not getting paid as promptly. Is this a big issue, a little issue? How much visibility do you have into it, given that you represent everybody from the biggest of the bigs to the smallest of the smalls?
Yeah, we're looking at it. And I it's an issue because of the environment we're living in today and in this pandemic and the workforce and ability to put people into services organizations or production lines. And we're still in COVID. I mean, we're still having, it's not near what the height was back in April, but we're still having closures of companies that have an outbreak or, there's a nest of people that you have to quarantine. You're still having to social distance. You're having to do PPE. You're having to do cleaning. You're not even able necessarily to bring your entire workforce together like you used to, so your production is not as rapid. So we're still undergoing those problems, and it's not over by any stretch of the imagination. I think the big companies and DoD are trying, and I think they've made some progress, but there's still going to be challenges. And it's a process, and if you look at our supply chains and some of these, and the level and the process to flow that money down, you still have oversight. You still have to make sure everything is done properly. You still have challenges maybe with at-home workers and their ability to access things, although we're getting much better at that as well. So is it an issue? Yeah, I think it will be an issue as long as we're in this environment. Our companies, are the big companies trying? Yeah, I think Lockheed, I think, has done a tremendous job. I think all the bigs have tried to flow money down to their suppliers. And I think in many cases they're being successful. But there are cases, where maybe it's not reaching there. Maybe there's a process challenge along the way. Maybe there's a telework challenge. Maybe there's a, a contractual cleanse problem. It's an issue we got to be cognizant of. We got to continue to monitor it. We got to do everything we can to help these mids and smalls because they're critical to the success of the defense industrial base. And so we got to be cognizant. When we find a challenge, we address it. That's one of the values, I think, of the being able to have such great contact with ANS inside OSD is when we hear things, we bring it up instantly and we get people to address the challenge. So we are still monitoring it. It can be an issue, and it has in the past. But I think the big companies and DOD are working really hard to solve those problems as quickly as they can.
Hawk, thanks very much for spending so much time with us. It's always an honor and pleasure, and look forward to having you on again soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Fargo. It was great talking to you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.